the things that we're going to talk about, I believe, are important things. And I suppose that the reason that Job mentioned, and I think he's mentioned that, is simply because I've lived through an important time in history, in the history of the church especially, and in the history of our nation as well, because of all of the different changes that have taken place. And so because of whatever experience I may have had, maybe I did learn a few things. Experience, after all, is a great teacher, you know. You remember that Jacob had some experience with Laban, his father-in-law, and God prospered him because he was faithful to God. And Laban realized that in Genesis 30 and verse 27, when Jacob departed from him and took his family and his possessions with him, Laban confronted him and said to him, "I pray thee, if I found favor in thine eyes, tarry, for I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake." And so we need to learn some things by means of experience. Somebody said, life has many great teachers, disappointment, pain, sorrow, love, death, but it is doubtful if there is one greater than experience. And somebody else said, a wise man learns by the experience of others. An ordinary man learns by his own experience. A fool learns by nobody's experience. And I think that is absolutely true. So let's talk about some things that I've learned in 70 years of preaching. First of all, I've learned that affluence can be a dangerous thing. Now, we live, of course, in the richest nation on earth. And that's a blessing. All of us consider it a blessing. And yet, even though it may be a blessing, it also can be a curse. Because there are things that go along with affluence that are not necessarily good. They challenge us. It challenges us in various ways. And the Bible has some things to say about that. You know, the land in which we live is richer than any land on earth, and I believe because God has blessed it and made it possible for that to be true. But at the same time, even though we are the greatest and the richest nation on earth, things can change drastically, as I mentioned in the previous lesson. We need to realize that how rich we are. I mean, you might say, well, I'm not rich. You know, I don't have much money. Well, actually, you do in comparison with the rest of the world. The average American has more money and goods than about 95 to 98% of the rest of the world. And so that ought to make us realize how rich we really are. But riches not only can be a blessing, they can be a curse. And of course, that's evident in different ways. When America was poor, it was strong. When America was poor, it had faith in God. It trusted in God. You know, back in olden times, even as late as the Depression years, the Great Depression years, there were far more people who were very religiously inclined than there are now. And so when we became rich and affluent, all of that seems to have changed. It moved away from God when it became rich. We used to have this motto, "In God we trust." Well, it's still on some of our money, but it has changed drastically in the minds of most people in America today. Because we trust in our armaments, we trust in our bank account, we trust in material things rather than in God. That is, as a nation, we do that. When we start to trust in ourselves and in our armaments and in materialism, then we get weak. And the Bible warns us about that as a nation. In Jeremiah 17 and verse 5, the prophet said, "Thus saith the Lord, cursed be the man that trusteth in man, and maketh flesh his arm, and whose heart departeth from the Lord." Whenever we trust in man, in ourselves or other men, we're in trouble. Again, in Psalms 9 and verse 17, the psalmist said, "The wicked shall be turned into hell, and all nations that forget God." That needs to be emphasized, because that's where we are as a nation today. When brethren were poor, then the church was strong. Back in the days, you know, when we didn't have much as a brotherhood, and when we lived in buildings that were not very nice, just, you know, not very accommodative, we were strong as a church. But that changed in time whenever we became prosperous. We didn't have the money back in those prior days, you know, to do a lot of things that later on, when we got prosperous and we had a lot of money, and brethren had a lot of money, then problems arose because, you know, there were all kinds of projects that began to creep into brethren's minds and into the church, and it caused a lot of trouble. We'll talk about some of that later. Having wealth is not a sinful thing. Some of God's greatest servants were wealthy people, Abraham, Lot, and Job. But even so, the Bible warns us of the dangers of wealth, of materialism. Proverbs 30 and 8, "Remove far from me vanity and lies, give me neither poverty nor riches." Why? Well, because poverty, you know, it leads to temptation, maybe causes people to steal or do things like that. And riches, on the other hand, leads us away from God and causes us to trust in our riches, in our material things. So he says, don't give me either one. In 1 Timothy 6, 17 and 18, or through 18, Paul said, "Charge them that are rich in this world." And you say, "Well, I'm not rich." Yes, you are. Yeah, you're rich. All of us are. So he's talking to us. "Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who giveth us richly all things to enjoy, that they do good, that they be rich in good works, ready to distribute, willing to communicate, laying up in store for themselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life." So we need to be sure that our sense of values is what it ought to be, and make sure that we're careful about the dangers of affluence. Another lesson I think I've learned is the fact that it's easy to become conditioned to sin. Very easy. You know, if sinful things just suddenly occur in our lives, if they come abruptly, then, you know, we take notice of that and we act quickly against that. That's human nature. But on the other hand, if sin just slips in slowly, a little bit at a time, then we get used to it. We have a tendency to become accustomed to sinful things when it comes in a little bit at a time. And there are truly powerful forces in America that are trying to condition us, you know, in certain directions, in certain ways. There is an agenda that is striving to make all Americans accept some particular philosophy in regards to faith and morals. And they are eroding the faith and morals of Americans and Christians, a little bit at a time. The media is doing that, as well as the entertainment industry, movies and various other aspects of the entertainment industry. They have been doing that for a long time. And we have slowly become accustomed to things that we would not have been accustomed to a few years ago. The humanistic influences that are everywhere in colleges and school systems and permeated almost every aspect of society, it's an atheistic, godless kind of a philosophy. It has influenced people a little bit at a time. And just look at the change in public tolerance of various types of morality over the past few years. We mentioned some of that in the previous lessons. In a Gallup poll, which was conducted over a number of years, there was a question asked each time. In 1969, the question was, do you think it is wrong for a man and woman to have sexual relations before marriage? Well, at that particular time, in that poll, 68% said, yes, it's wrong. Well, that same question was asked again in 1973. And in that poll, only 47% answered, yes, it's wrong for a man and woman to have sexual relations before marriage. And then in 2015, just a short time ago, only 36% thought, that it was wrong for a man and a woman to have sexual relations before marriage. You see how that has progressed and changed in the tolerance of such? And of course, today we live in a time when people can't be embarrassed hardly. We've almost passed the stage where even good people can't be embarrassed about things because of what is on the media, television, and movies, and in everyday life walking down the street. And that was true of the people of God long ago, in the days when Israel was in apostasy, and when Israel was being warned about what would happen if they continued in the same way. In Jeremiah 6 and verse 15, Jeremiah asked the question, were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? Nay, they were not at all ashamed, neither could they blush. Therefore they shall fall among them that fall. And just before they went into captivity, they had gotten to this point that they could not blush. They were not ashamed of the things going on in their society. We need to be careful, because that very thing could very easily happen to us as well. We have to constantly be on guard against being or getting used to sin. Well, another lesson I've learned is the fact that there is an ever-present danger of apostasy. As someone said, we are always only one generation away from apostasy as a church. And I think that's certainly accurate. The Jews, you remember, went into apostasy only one generation after they conquered the Promised Land. They went through the wilderness wanderings. And God blessed them in so many ways, performed so many signs and wonders, led them through the wilderness and then into the Promised Land, led them to conquer that land. And those people, that generation, remained faithful to the Lord because they had experienced all of these wonders and blessings from God. But look what it says about the next generation. In Judges chapter 2, beginning in verse 7, it says, and the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord that He did for Israel. And also all that generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which He had done for them. So it happened to them, and it has happened numerous times since that as well. You know, today, some children of faithful parents become disobedient and rebellious and fail to serve the Lord. And it's not the fault of the parents, necessarily, in most cases. They may be good, faithful parents. They may have trained their children well. But then a new generation comes along that didn't have the experiences that the parents had. Maybe the parents had to struggle in order to learn the truth. Or maybe they had to sacrifice and struggle in order to continue faithful through their years. And they grew stronger as a result of that. But their children have kind of inherited their faith, if you please, and didn't have to do all of that struggle. And as a result of that, they are weak and easily led astray. That happens all too often. And it happens, of course, in the church as well. We see it time and time again. For example, back after the death of the apostles, it wasn't long. A matter of a few years after John died, really, that the church began, in a small way, to go into apostasy. And over a period of time, it went into a complete apostasy at that time. And then, after the restoration of the Lord's church in the 1800s, when the New Testament church was restored through the efforts of various great men, it wasn't but just maybe 50 years that there was apostasy over the missionary society. Instrumental music was introduced, and a number of those people continued in that apostasy until they went into denominationalism. And there have been later apostasies since that time. Premillennialism, the Ketcherside Garrett apostasy, and some others as well. But there have been many times when, there have been those that have turned away from the Lord after a faithful generation had passed. So it can happen, and it does happen, and we need to be aware of that, and we need to always be on guard of that very thing taking place to us, because it can, and it will, if we're not very careful about that. Take heed, Jesus said, that you be not deceived. First Peter warns. He says, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, is a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour. The devil is out there. Make no mistake about it. He's alive, he's active, he's out there, and he's watching for every opportunity to destroy God's people and God's cause. And he will not give up. And so we have to be on guard and make sure that we do not allow that to happen in our lives. Another lesson that I've learned is the fact that apostasy usually starts little and ends big. I've seen that firsthand, and history testifies that it's occurred on many different occasions, because it acts like a cancer. It may start, like a small cancer, but it spreads and spreads and spreads until it has destroyed the Lord's people. And so there are people who start into apostasy, and then that spreads, and finally they are led into digression altogether. We need to be careful about that. Go back to the apostasy of the second century, for example, after the death of the apostles. That apostasy started with rejecting the plurality of elders. God's plan was that each congregation should have a plurality of elders. That's the pattern. And each of these elders were equal in authority. One was not over the other. They were simply shepherds of the flock. But what happened in history was that in a group of elders, one was appointed to be the chairman or the spokesman for the others in business meetings and the like. And in time, that one who was the chairman, it was looked upon him as having greater importance and greater authority than the others, and he became known as the bishop of that church. And then, in time, as the bishops of various churches, metropolitan bishops and country bishops and all would get together in their various meetings and discuss the church and problems and what have you, that they would appoint one over them. And that one then, in time, would become more important than the rest of them. Archbishop, cardinal, and ultimately the universal pope came about. And all of that started in a small way, but look at how it ended. Well, you know, the same thing happened in the 1800s in a little different way. When the church was restored through the preaching of those great men in the 1800s, they went forth declaring, "Let us speak where the Bible speaks. Let us be silent where the Bible is silent. Let us call Bible things by Bible names. Do Bible things in Bible ways." And they converted thousands of people. Many churches grew up. And they were faithful churches that were patterned after the New Testament church. But, you know, the mentality that justified the missionary society, that allowed the missionary society to exist, was the same kind of mentality that led those who accepted that idea into total denominationalism in a matter of a relative few years. And so the churches of Christ that went in that direction were in the majority, and they ultimately became what is known as the Christian church. Another denomination accepting so many things the Bible does not teach. So it started little and ended big. And the same thing has happened during the 40s and 50s and since that time in the church in general. When I started preaching, the church was united. It was one large united brotherhood. And as I said earlier, it was the fastest growing church in America. But then, little by little, things began to enter in which were not according to the pattern that we have in the Scriptures. For example, sponsoring church arrangements on a small scale. There had been a few of those back earlier, maybe back in the 30s, on a local level. A small scale, not many, but a few, and not much opposition was raised about those because they were localized. But then in the 40s, or the late 40s and 50s, there were sponsoring arrangements that were huge, much bigger. A Broadway Church in Lubbock, Texas, decided after the war to sponsor the missionary work of Germany, to take over the sponsorship of that and call on churches all over America to send funds to them so that they could control that work, oversee that work. And along the same line, Union Avenue Church in Memphis, Tennessee decided to do the same thing with Japan, to take over the Japanese missionary work upon that same basis. And there were other similar things. Highland Avenue Church in Abilene, Texas, decided to start a nationwide radio and television program. Started out as a radio program, and later they added the television program to it, called the Herald of Truth. And so it started on that basis, as a sponsoring arrangement, churches everywhere sending funds to them, and they take the oversight of this work of sending, preaching the gospel over, you know, the radio and television. And so it started in a little way, but it kept expanding and expanding until it blew up into some big unscriptural arrangement. Church support of institutions, such as the Institutional Orphans Home, led to the church support of colleges and the church support of a number of other different institutions. Homes for unwed mothers, and hospitals, things of that kind. It started out by, you know, trying to defend the church supporting an orphan's home. It became an emotional issue because people did not understand what the real issue was. It wasn't a question of whether brethren can help orphans. It was a question of whether the church can support an institution that helps orphans. So it wasn't just a matter of method. It was a matter of institution employing a method and taking care of them. But whenever that battle was fought, and enough people were convinced that that was all right, and of course there was opposition to it, but whenever that battle was fought, and enough people were convinced that it was all right to do that, the next step was to say, well, if the church can support this institution, it can support a college. And so, that came in next, the church supporting Bible colleges. And then that led to other human institutions to be supported by the church. And it was a progress from little to big. And then, sort of at the same time, churches began to say, well, you know, they had dinner on the grounds for a long time. And I don't think anybody ever saw any problem with that because everybody brought their own food and just put it out under a shade tree and ate it. But they decided, look, we've got a room in the basement that we're not using. Let's make that room in the basement. Let's fix it up as a kitchen. And let's have our meals there. So that was introduced. And from that, they said, well, let's just build us some fellowship halls so that we can, you know, have our own building for that purpose. And so it escalated into that and into gymnasiums built by church funds. And then church-sponsored ball teams. This is the Church of Christ ball team versus the Baptist ball team over here. And on it went. I mean, infinitive. Just continued on and on and on. Also, these innovations led to controversy, understandably, to debates, and ultimately to open division in the church. Because there were many brethren who were bent on following this trend of doing things for which there is no in addition to that, and along about the same time, there was a tendency to watered down weak preaching among mainstream churches of Christ. And when I use that word mainstream, I simply mean the majority who followed that trend. The minority who opposed it were called, you know, antis or conservatives, and those who followed that trend were called liberals because they were taking liberties with the gospel. So a watered-down, weak type of preaching kind of filtered in. And a part of this, in fact, a major part of this, was due to the influence of the Herald of Truth radio program in Abilene. Because a number of their speakers, young men who were good speakers, and they started out well as far as the message that they presented. They started out with firm messages on the distinctiveness of the church and the plan of salvation and all of that. But over a period of about 10 years, that all changed because they saw that really the people that were listening were those who were listening to these evangelistic, denominational evangelists who were preaching feel-good type of preaching. You know, make you feel good. That can justify your actions and just make you feel good. And so they evolved into that type of preaching on Herald of Truth. And since, you know, nearly everybody listened to the Herald of Truth, young men, young preachers, began to imitate that very same kind of preaching. And as a result, that kind of took over the type of preaching that was being heard, especially among the mainstream churches of Christ, which was the majority of brethren. Those who opposed these practices were in the minority. This is a statement made from a historian by the name of Richard Hughes. He is a historian in Pepperdine University, which is a very liberal university. And he himself is very liberal. He admits, you know, that the mainstream churches of Christ have actually developed into another denomination. He admits that so. He believes he's a part of that. He thinks that's okay. And so he would disagree with us with reference to that, you know, principle. But he is a historian. He wrote a book called Reviving the Ancient Faith. And in that book, he wrote very objectively about, you know, what had really happened. Among other things, here's what he said. Churches of Christ found that they could not expect to compete effectively in the denominational free market of souls unless they embraced the sort of peace of mind piety that had dominated the national religious landscape for more than a decade. With increasing frequency, the Herald of Truth explained to national radio and television audiences how to achieve spiritual growth and peace of mind, how to develop healthy family relationship, and how to cope with anxiety and fear or with the various stages along the way. Now, mind you, there's nothing wrong with those thoughts. And no doubt they are needed in certain circumstances. But when you have a steady diet of that and do not have the first principles taught, then it's going to lead to a problem. And this historian points that out. He says, one, and this is by the 1970s, one could listen to preachers in churches of Christ for weeks and months on and never hear anything remotely approaching the message that had defined them for a century and a half. Now, this is a man in the liberal group writing a history about what happened, and he said, this is what happened. This is a change that took place. And I think it certainly escalated, you know, the trend into denominationalism of the mainstream churches of Christ. A lack of book, chapter, and verse, doctrinal preaching will destroy conviction. It did then, and let me tell you, it will now. Mind you, most of the preaching that I hear today is good, sound preaching among us, but I'm afraid there's a little bit of a trend, and there are a few that are kind of headed in this kind of preaching direction. We need to beware of that, because if we don't hear good, sound, doctrinal preaching, we're going to lose our conviction. That's the way it works. And so, that's one of the changes that took place. And then the social gospel filtered in and further contributed to the apostasy that was already well on its way. And as a result of these things, the mainline churches of Christ today are facing a major split. split. And may I underline the word major? There are some among the brethren in the mainline churches that are trying, you know, to hold the line. They still have accepted things that we would not accept and things that, you know, we believe are not according to the pattern. But they're still trying to hold the line otherwise. But listen to this. There's a group among them, a large group among them. They call themselves the change agents or the progressives. And they advocate instrumental music. They've added instrumental music to their worship. They advocate women preachers, women elders, and they don't believe that baptism is essential to salvation. They would accept people on open membership, regardless of how they had been converted. And that's going on among them. Half or more of their membership and most all of their colleges have been caught up in this particular movement. This is again from, this is from Gregory Allen Tidwell, who is the present editor of the Gospel Advocate. The Gospel Advocate is the main paper, the main religious journal among the mainstream churches of Christ. And I have personally met him and personally heard him say the very thing that I have up there on the board. In one of his lectures that I heard, he said this: virtually half of the membership and almost all of the colleges associated with Churches of Christ have moved to the progressive side. And that's alarming, because again, it highlights the fact that apostasy starts little and it ends big. And then here is another statement that this same man has made about his personal experience. He said, "We need to see also the distinctive nature of salvation. For me, this is very personal. My home congregation in Nashville, where I grew up in the Lord's church, has abandoned requiring immersion for membership. On any particular Sunday morning, if you were to visit, the man presiding at the Lord's table may have been sprinkled as an infant, not immersed. They view baptism as an optional extra, not as the new birth into Christ. The same congregation also embraces full and open view of accepting homosexuals without repentance." So, this is the trend, and already, half of those associated with the mainstream churches of Christ have gone with this trend, and probably, I hope not, but probably there will be more that will follow that trend as well. Now, it's not ours to, you know, to sit back and say, "Well, I told you so." Maybe we told them so, but that isn't anything for us to gloat about or to rejoice about in any sense. We need to weep about that. Because I'll tell you something, it can happen to us. Us who are the conservative group of churches of Christ, if you please. The same thing can happen to us. I suppose that you have heard the story about how you can take a frog. You can put him in a pan of water, set that pan of water on the stove, cold water, put him in there, and then you turn the heat up slowly, and you let that water just slowly warm up until finally it reaches the boiling point. The frog never knows the difference until he's dead. It's too late. And that can happen to you and to me. It can happen to conservative churches of Christ. We have to be careful about those things, because apostasy starts little and ends big. And also I've learned that the popular way is usually wrong. It was in Noah's day. Some brethren, you know, take their stand on the basis of what is popular. They wait and see how the wind is blowing. And then take their stand upon the basis of how does the majority feel about this or that. They did that during this last apostasy. And that's simply the wrong way to view it, because the majority is usually wrong. It's been wrong in every apostasy. It was wrong in the beginning. It's wrong during the 1800s. And it was wrong, in the apostasy of the 50s and 60s. And it was wrong in Noah's day. And even in Jesus' day, when He came, only a remnant, only a few, really, were faithful to Him. And only a remnant of Jews were faithful in Old Testament times. The great majority of Jews departed from God into idolatry. Only a few were faithful. And only a remnant followed Jesus in His day. Paul mentions that in Romans 11 and 5. Even so then, at this present time also there is a remnant. That means remainder. What's left over. A remnant according to the election of grace. But let me tell you, brethren, there's a remnant today. And I suppose that we will always, God's people will always be a remnant. The majority went with the Missionary Society and instrumental music in the 1800s. I mean 80%. And the majority endorsed institutionalism in the 50s, as we've already pointed out. And when Christians face doctrinal issues, what do we do about that? We look in the book. We look for book, chapter, and verse. We look for Bible authority. We look for the Bible pattern. And if we don't, we're in trouble. When we face moral questions, as we do every day in this country, what do we do about that? We look in the book. When we want to know, you know, what is right about this or that, whether should I go to this place or that place, should I look at this or that, should I dress this way or that way, look in the book. Because the answers are there if we are willing to accept the answers. God warns us about, you know, the popular way. He says, thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil. Be careful. Standing for the truth is often costly. I hope I'm not going too far over. Standing for the truth is often costly. That's another lesson that I've learned. Because it is. Truth is very valuable. Truth is something that really costs something. The wise man said, buy the truth and sell it not. Buy it. It doesn't matter what it costs. Buy it. Pay the price because it's valuable. And don't sell it for anything. It's more valuable than anything else. And in John 8:32, Jesus said, ye shall know the truth. The truth shall make you free. That's why it's valuable. It's the truth. The truth shall make you free. It can give you freedom. And the only thing that can give us spiritual freedom is the truth. And so we need to be willing to pay the price. Think of what Moses paid for truth in his day. Think of the price that he paid. Think of the price that the prophets paid. They were persecuted because they spoke the truth. Think about the early Christians who were persecuted to death over and over again because they stood for the truth. It costs something to them. And standing for the truth among brethren is often costly. I'll tell you, going through the division of the 40s and 50s and 60s, it was an unpleasant experience. It was difficult for everybody. It was costly because not only were churches divided, families were divided. Brethren who had been lifelong friends were divided. And it just became a very, very difficult time for everybody. It cost something to stand for the truth. But of course, standing for the truth, regardless of the cost, is always the best way to go. Now, it's of course preferable preferable rather, to avoid division if we can. We need to love unity. We need to try to avoid division if there's any way of doing that short of compromising the truth. We cannot do that and please God. We have to stand for what's right. And Jesus tells us about the cost of truth. In Matthew 10, beginning in verse 34, He said, "Think not that I'm come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I'm come to set a man at variance against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And he that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." It costs to serve the Lord. And yet, failing to pay the price of truth is much costlier. Jesus said, "For whosoever shall be ashamed of me and my words, of him shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he shall come in his own glory and his Father's and of the holy angels." When the Lord comes again, you know, if we have been ashamed, if we have not stood up for what is right and what is taught in His Word, He said, "I'll be ashamed of you too because you were ashamed of me." We need to be sure we understand that. Well, one other thing, I may have gone a little over. This is an entirely different kind of a subject, but I thought I'd bring this in. That success, this is something I think I've learned, that success in life depends more on attitude than it does on ability. You know, we have to have the right attitude to be successful, even if we don't have ability. Part of that means that we have to maintain a faith in God. And part of it means that we need to have a faith in ourselves. In 1 John 5 and 4, he says, "Whatsoever is born of God overcometh the world, and this is the victory that overcometh the world, even our faith." Faith in God. Faith in His Word. As well as faith in ourselves to an extent is necessary in order for us to be successful in whatever endeavor that we may choose. I want to say to you, who are older in particular, don't die before you die. Now you know some people do that. Some people die before they're dead. I mean, they just give up. They just decide, "Well, I'm just of no use. I'm too old to do anything." And they quit trying. Don't do that. Don't die before you're dead. Because old folks have a lot to offer. A lot more than a lot of folks think. The Bible even teaches that. Psalm 92, verse 12 beginning, "The righteous shall flourish like the palm tree. He shall grow like a cedar in Lebanon. Those that be planted in the house of the Lord shall flourish in the courts of God. They shall still bring forth fruit in old age. They shall be fat and flourishing." Well, I don't know about the flourishing part. I'm beginning to feel a little bit about the other. But let's remember that as older folks, you know, we have something to offer to the world, to the brethren, to our children, to our grandchildren. Don't die before you're dead. Stay active. As much as your body will allow, stay active. And learn to laugh at yourself. You know, old folks do things a lot of times that are funny. They do things that, are laughable. And I know that, you know, some others would like to laugh at some of the things I do and do. But we need to learn to laugh at ourselves. Whenever we get old, we need to remember that everything hurts and what doesn't hurt doesn't work. We need to remember, if your knees buckle, I mean, that you get to a point where your knees buckle but your belt won't. That happens. When you're old, you decide to forget the health foods because you need all the preservatives you can get. I do. When you get old, you stoop to tie your shoes and wonder what else you can do while you're down there. Isn't that right? When you get old, you think to yourself, if God wanted me to touch my toes, He would have put them on my knees. Oh, yes. You spend a lot of time thinking of the hereafter. You go somewhere for something and wonder what you're here after. And you sink your teeth into a good steak and they stay there. Yeah. Well, we need to learn to laugh at ourselves. We need to maintain a good attitude. And I like so much the attitude of this person who wrote this poem, because I think it really supports the thing I'm talking about. You tell me I'm getting old? I tell you that's not so. The house I live in is worn out, and that, of course, I know. It's been in use a long, long while. It's weathered many a gale. I'm really not surprised you think I'm getting somewhat frail. The color's changing on the roof. The window's getting dim. The wall's a bit transparent and looking rather slim. The foundation's not so steady as once it used to be. My house is getting shaky, but my house isn't me. My few short years can't make me old. I feel I'm in my youth. Eternity lies just ahead, a life of joy and truth. I'm going to live forever there. Life will go on. It's grand. You tell me I'm getting old? You just don't understand. The dweller in my little house is young and bright and gay, just starting on a life to last throughout eternal day. You only see the outside, which is all that most folks see. You tell me I'm getting old, you've mixed my house with me. Song of invitation has been selected. Prepare to meet thy God. And that's something all of us need to be striving to do. Make preparation. If you have not obeyed the gospel, if you have not become a child of God, there is no better time than right now. We have no guarantee of tomorrow. But now is the time that you need to come in response to that, making things right with God, being baptized into Christ, or making your life, if you need to repent of sins in a public way, why not do that now? Why not come while we stand together and while we sing?